250 inch and a half that will at some point be installed.
Wow.
Some of them this year, some in the future. So
that's an interesting stat. It's a lot. Okay, cool.
I'll give you, knowing that, I'll do a little more of a breakdown on what we expect to install and how many are out there that could be installed kind of thing for you.
Yeah. I mean, it was really exciting when they first started going in, so it's kind of cool to watch them continue.
Yeah. Well, and then one of the things that we have to plan on is a 7 to 10 year life.
Well, that's another reason why I was asking, is like, so, I'm assuming they're going to break down at some point. I'll have to just like keep buying these.
Yeah.
But they sound reasonably cost. It's not like they're a couple thousand a piece or something.
No.
Okay. And then just a comment that I saw the, is it Ameresco, the Signal Hill floating PV system?
Yeah, we're
so that's scheduled to start.
I would say May, I think, is what Chris says, is when they're going to start actually being on site doing some stuff.
And then reminder, what was the total?
About $1.8 million total.
Okay, so this is just the preliminary.
Yeah, this is kind of the work, the engineering work up front. And then if you'll recall, you know, over half of that's going to be paid by the grant and the tax credit.
Right. We're waiting. The building permit's been submitted for that. We're just waiting for approval.
Okay. And then Flare Construction Equipment Rental, LC Booster Supplies. So I just thought it was labeled weird because Flare's like a construction company. But
previously, Weber Basin had a piece of equipment down at Lost Canyon to dig the ice out of the river or keep the ice out of the river.
Yep.
And since we took over the maintenance or the control of the intake, we leased a piece of equipment for a couple months so the guys could readily get into the river.
From Flare?
Yes, from Flare.
So, okay, so it's a piece of equipment.
Yeah, that's what that might have been misclassed as supplies.
It says supplies, but it's actually a piece of equipment just to get there. Cool.
And we'll continue to do that. So instead of waiting for a piece of equipment to get there, the guys can just get in.
Yeah, yeah.
Move it and get on.
Until you move the intake.
Yes.
Which you will do at some point, right?
Yes, maybe.
Maybe. Save having to do all that work. Okay, and then my last one. I saw the USA Blue Book. There was a whole bunch of like safety supplies, harnesses, tripod. How much work do we do, like confined space where we're lowering people down and need to have a harness on?
You can do it monthly. Then
we still have to like lower people down into
the we set it up to where we don't lower them in, but we're harnessed up, tripod ready to go for rescue.
In case there's like an air issue.
Those harnesses, we replaced them and we had them, their original harnesses, so we thought it would be time to.
They have a shelf life on them that they're supposed to be replaced.
Yeah.
We should just have like, you know, three of them laying around, and now we've got one for everyone.
Well, that's awesome that we have all our own kits around.
Yeah.
Yeah, thankfully you guys are doing that. And the goal is kind of to limit how many of those PRVs we have to go down into moving forward, or try to move ones up above ground if we can.
Yeah, we spec is above ground. Nice. We still have, you know, 80 plus below ground vaults, so.
Yeah. So monthly. Okay, cool. That's it for me. Thank you.
Did anyone else have a check register question? I have a couple. Surprise, surprise. we have an InfoWater subscription. Is that that was $8,800?
January or February?
Probably January.
That's the hydraulic modeling software we use at the district. So we maintain like a digital replica, essentially, of the distribution system and use it maybe not every day, but most days.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, so it's a critical piece of software that we use a lot in our department.
And then some county health funding, is that just our health insurance?
Yeah.
Okay. And then
that was a bigger check to Summit County for the land loan. Sorry.
Oh, this looked like it was a monthly charge because it was in January and February.
Yeah, that's the health insurance.
And then there were HSA contributions, and that just done in January for the...
Yeah, for all the employees.
Okay, and then I saw we bought an emergency food supply. Are we expecting the apocalypse, or...?
I didn't see that one.
It's kind of... Oh, hold up, Brian.
For recovery, what started was like the tsunami for band that demolished. So after that, we started getting emergency food supply, and we had enough for every employee at the time. We also got emergency water, so we just kind of added to it, and, you know, our employee base is expanded to about the bubble.
So do we have it here at the office, or we have it at our remote location?
At the time.
Okay.
That's kind of our operation central, so there's enough for every employee, just, you know, 50 or so wise.
Hope we never need it.
So, just walk over to the treatment plant if it does apocalypse start.
Oh, that's true. Okay. I noticed we, somebody applied to the Women of Water organization, and I was wondering in a state like Utah, how many people are actually in that organization?
I'm the wrong guy to ask.
Is that Jess?
I think it's Jess.
Some of the women I work with.
Probably that girl that works for Park City, right? She's
Michelle.
Michelle.
Yeah, Christina Osborne, a guy who works at J&B Engineers, founded it, local in Utah. Yeah, she's great. It seems like they do a really nice job.
Yeah. Well, it's nice to know that we have that. We had a well siting report, and I just wondered where we were trying to site the well.
Yeah, so we had a future well included in our master plan. So this is kind of a follow-up to it. It's hard to come up with a cost estimate and, you know, nail things down if we haven't selected the actual site for the well. So we took the next step with the well siting study. And we can provide it to any of the board members on request if you're interested. Happy to do so.
So we were looking at multiple sites.
Yeah, so my take on it was essentially, you know, take a step back, you know, infrastructure side and the whole basin. Where's our best opportunity for potential for groundwater? And that's kind of the guidance we gave to these LRE folks. And then we got together, met, and Brian was a big part of that, and then kind of actually talked about more nuts and bolts, like how would this work at different sites, what's realistic and what's not. And that kind of got formalized into this report. And then next year we could, you know, take the option to actually do some more investigative work, do some actual field work to kind of further flesh these things out. So that's the idea. It's a long-term play. We're just trying to do the homework ahead of time so we're not scrambling.
That makes sense.
Like next year, maybe do the exploration bore at a location?
Something like that.
And do it for testing?
Yeah. So we'll think about that when we start putting the budget together for next year.
Okay.
Cool. And then the back trailer was, did we already have a PO for that one?
Yeah. Okay. And under 50, Andy and I can sign it.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. That was it for me on the... check register. Do we have a motion to approve the consent agenda?
Motion to approve the consent agenda as discussed.
And a second?
Second.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Aye, that's unanimous. we're on to Sam.
Is that recording?
Yes. You know, we had kind of some big picture discussions last board meeting, and I thought it would be helpful kind of have something to look at to facilitate those discussions. So with Jess's help, put together just a couple pictures to kind of talk about supply and demand in the basin. I don't have much prepared except just share these and kind of give you my take on it. And it can be really short and brief and move on, or there's additional discussion, I guess we can have that too. So I'll just start. This is a super simplified version of what's going on with the basin with the three main water providers. Obviously, these boundaries are all intermingled, and we can show those, but the intent here was just to keep it on big picture level. So here's just a view of the greater basin. Mountain Regional kind of sitting around here, Summit Water has a lot of service over here, and then Park City, of course, is within the municipal boundary. So then the next two figures kind of show, hey, if you're going to zoom out and look at the basin from a supply and demand perspective, what would that look like? And the first piece is current or very close to current peak day demands, and then the second piece we'll look at is build-out numbers with the best build-out information or projections we've gathered from all the other players. So this year, through the regionalization agreement, Summit Water is contracted to take up to 1,400 GPM instantaneously. So they're allocated, they're on the hook to buy a certain amount of water, and of course that's expressed in volume, and then you're allowed to peak it by a factor of two for delivery, so you can get an instantaneous flow rate. So that's where that number comes from.
So they can get 2,800 instantaneously?
No, mm-hmm. That's in flow rate. So this is all peak day. Okay. So all the numbers we're talking about, these next two sites. Yeah, that's rock the you know irrigation season.
Yeah, that's the hard one. Okay.
Yep. And then Mountain Regional, we're sitting about flush, and we can talk about that more. But you know, we presented kind of where we were and what projections look like during the board retreat, that big master planning effort. And I've talked about that a fair bit, but there's kind of the breakdown. We have a pretty significant well supply. Got 1,800 GPM. There's a typo right there. It says PM, not GPM. and then those are the approximate demand numbers. So we're kind of, I don't know, we're covered, but there's not a lot of wiggle room there, I guess. And then just, for example, I mean, it's pretty easy math, but if you just, for example, just wipe Signal Hill off, you just flip the switch, we don't have Signal Hill anymore, then we're at a significant deficit, negative 1,700 GPM or so.
Where does the 1,400 for summer come from?
Between Mountain Regional and Park City. Yeah, so yeah. We're slated to deliver water, summit water this year, as a result of what we call the settlement water. I don't know the name of the specific lawsuit, but you know, at a reduced rate, from my understanding, that's meant to be punitive to the district. And then, go ahead, sorry.
Is that 1,400 and the 4,700 yard amount?
Oh, good point. So that's slightly misleading. I kind of played around with different ways to show this, but I could have. The delivery of summit water is included in those NR numbers. Okay. So the plus 100 includes us our required delivery of summit water.
That 1,400 is part
of our... No, you picked up on that pretty quick. I didn't...
I missed that.
I didn't know how to show that well while keeping it as simple as possible, but you just sniffed out the main thing there.
It's in our 4,700 demand.
Yes.
Yeah. And Park City doesn't provide any to summit.
No, they provide significant. They're picking up the slack, essentially.
So as we're decreasing, Park City is increasing, mm-hmm. basically one-to-one, and then they're adding on to Summit's demand. Summit has a source deficit right now. They have some significant challenges.
What was our last year providing to Summit?
700 acre-feet, and that's that again this year.
This is the last year.
This is the last year.
And then next year, 2025.
No, we
December 31st, 2025, we're done.
That's the last year.
Thanks, Sam.
Sure. And then Park City's kind of more complicated with Three Kings coming online, but it's not really super pertinent here. And then the only existing interconnect from Park City to the other two systems is through the Highway 40 system. We talk about that a lot.
So that's the most we can buy from Park City?
So the most water that can get transported from Park City, and it's actually to Summit, and potentially back to us, but again, that's not really critical for this exercise. The Highway 40 system's been tested at just under 1,100 GPM. So you could call it 1,100 or call it 1,000 GPM. I always just use 1,100 as a ballpark number. So that's what this system currently provides. And obviously, legal ownership, I'm not the expert on that, but the way you read, or the way I've read the agreement is, we're essentially allocated 20% of 50% of that capacity. So on paper, that's not much. But let's just say, in a perfect world, we could use all of it, and Summit Water doesn't exist, or whatever the scenario is, that number's still 1,100, as it's just from a hydraulic perspective.
Does that come from Park City when it wheels through Mountain Regional to Summit?
Other way. It has to... the connection is gravity, essentially, from a tank in Park City. And I'm not familiar enough with the system to know the name off the top of my head.
I think it's Boot Hill.
Thank you. And it flows to the Section 27 tank and some of the water.
Okay.
Just an HCL. And the difference is in that potential, you know, head, potential energy, whatever you want to think about it, allow that 1,100 GPM that transfer. And then if we were to receive any of that water, which we have never done in the past, but the infrastructure is there, there's an interconnect between essentially the Section 27 tank and our distribution system right in front of it.
Because it's a little lower than the hill.
It's significant.
And then that's not as good for us.
Well, and the thought is, again, I wasn't involved when that got designed, the interconnector or whatnot, but the thought is this 1100 is the constraining factor, and the head differential between Summer Water Mountain Regional is significant. That it's never been tested, but I believe the thought is we could get 1100 GPM through the interconnect if we want it. But again, we've never, it's never been fired up, never tested, not that it won't work, but. That's how the system currently works. So it's technically wheeled through Summit, through this Highway 40 system with its complicated ownership structure to their Section 27 tank, come back down the hill to our distribution system, or transmission line there, whatever you want to think about. And then that comes into our Atkinson zone. So that's current day. So here's build-out numbers. So this... Well, I'll start at Summit again. This number, the negative 3,300, is where Summit's going to be at with the Canyons base getting built out. I believe that's like their main area of development that they're committed to in some fashion. And that number came straight from Mike Folkman over at Summit Water. So it was helpful to those folks to kind of see where they're at. Our negative 2,200... Again, this negative 2,200 number assumes we do nothing to increase our source portfolio. And again, that results from our master planning effort and where we're at our build-out scenario.
When did we hit build-out? What year was that?
So the Bowen Collins people, so I'm going to dodge your question a little bit.
That's
but
fine.
The Bowen Collins people kind of had a approach I thought was an improvement, which was interesting, where... they essentially were making it mathematically, so most of the growth happens kind of in the middle age of the district, and then as we get to build out, it gets harder and harder to get there.
Yeah.
So we use 2065 as a number, but that's a little misleading.
Yeah.
It's quite a bit sooner than that. It's just eking out that last
few
percent
during
the 2065 number. So they
that
use,
makes sense.
You know, mathematically a logistic curve. They like to say to hit there, and
so
I
somewhere in between, like try to the middle, just roughly back the envelope, kind of the middle between now and 65.
Yeah,
so something like that, 35 or something.
Okay, so now here's the proposed interconnect that's happening through the regionalization agreement. This happened along Highway 224. I don't have all the stats off the top of my head, but it's quite a bit of pipeline. It connects Park City to Summit. Mountain Regional has no ability to receive this water under the current construct of the project. But it's beneficial to Summit, as it, from my understanding, gets the water a better part of their system. They often have hydraulic limitations, even taking water from us, as is big time. And it's very advantageous from Park City, because they can send this water from their main hub of their water system. Again, I don't know the name, but they can essentially send any source they want via this interconnect. Whereas, as I understand it, the interconnect over on the east side of Park City, they're more limited in what water resources would be available. It's essentially Quinns would be the driver. Quinns Water Treatment Plant, kind of the sister plant located at Quinns Junction, would be the driver.
That interconnect on 224, just for some history, that was kind of first time I heard about it was before they started the colony.
Yeah.
Right? So that was 20, 25 years ago they've been.
Right. And it as a basin, I think it has a lot of pros.
Yeah.
You know, it from a resiliency standpoint, I think it makes a lot of sense. It doesn't directly benefit the district. Well, that's maybe a strong take.
It could be a long-term play for the district if and when an importation project happens.
Yeah.
It makes the loop work.
Yeah, and currently, you know, we're only looking at flown in north from Park City.
And is there good mapping out there that shows how close, like, residential connections are to one another between the two districts, between the
between
three districts?
Between non-regional and Cinelec? Oh, yeah, we have excellent GIS maps of all the systems. I'm just, for this is like, you know, preschool finger painting.
I'm just wondering, like, is a big transmission line necessary, or can you make smaller connections throughout the basin?
That's a really good question. The answer is basically, yeah, a big transmission line is. This is essentially, we've got a very long, dead spot with no conveyance. And it's logical, the design, or the concept, in my opinion, what they're running down. The Bowen Collins folks are kind of managing the project, and they know all the systems really well. They're a good fit to do it. And, that whole piece, I think, makes a lot of sense. And as it's currently sized, they model it at 2,400 GPM, which, again, I think is the perfect number, because essentially 2,400, 1,100, you get Park City's surplus.
Is that interconnect through the regionalization? Are we pitching in on that?
We are. So, again, as a long-term play, that we're basically buying in today, and if there is ever an importation project, we don't have to then try to buy in the future.
But legally, we have to go.
We went back and forth of whether or not we needed to.
Oh, okay.
But we decided internally it was in the best interest as insurance against. It would be a cheap investment today versus trying to do something down the road.
Yep.
What's
our Biden? We don't know the exact number yet, but probably about 1.8 million. Weaver Basin will fund that, the construction. We're not obligated to pay our portion until 2026.
What size is it?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it's there's a couple different sizes looked at for different conveyance options, and the 2400 GPM was, I think it's, actually, I'm not 100% sure. I think it's 16.
I thought it was between a 12 and a 16.
I think it's a 16. I have to. I don't want to give you the wrong answer. But we could easily find it.
What's the timeline on that?
So that's interesting. Summit needs the water, and they're contracted to take it. And they're quickly going to exceed the capacity of.
So Summit has a take-or-pay contract, and in January of 2026, if this is not in the ground, Summit cannot receive the water, and we're under no obligation to provide the water. So the contract was just awarded within the last 3 weeks for final full design. They're going to take the rest of this year and hope to start awarding construction beginning of 25, hopefully just build through 2025.
Is it going in under the highway or with the bus rapid transit project?
That has not fully been designed. I think they need to look at easements and what's there.
Yeah.
So basically it'll go from Holiday Ranch Loop to the White Barn approximately.
Mm-hmm.
And then Park City's doing some other upgrades, running fiber optic and a couple other things when the trench is open. So that's all still in the work. But if
and who will own that line?
Weber Basin will own it, and Park City will operate it, and then Summit Water will pay the expenses for it.
Is that pretty common that Weber Basin owns infrastructure?
As part of the regionalization, it is.
Okay, that exists elsewhere in the basin?
Yeah. They own, well, I forget the exact allocation of Highway 40, so part of the Highway 40 system, for example.
Yeah.
But then Summit owns 50, and then Weber Basin bought the other 50%. And then of that 50%, Summit's...
We own 20% of the remaining 50%.
But, like, if that pipe breaks, who's on the hook for going out and repairing that pipe?
More than likely, Park City would.
Okay.
But then Summit would pay for it. So the way the agreement worked is, he who receives the benefit pays the bill. So even though
I'm just thinking about maintenance, the ownership of the maintenance, I guess.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, Park City, since basically it's Park City's water, Park City will operate it. I don't know if we'll have any read-only SCADA on it like we do on some of the other sites, but it would become Park City's. And Park City, I think, will also manage the construction since they're here and boots on the ground, because it's more cost, it's more expensive to bring people in from Weber and have them do inspections and things like that.
Is that inside of the city limits?
Part of it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, runs of the Jewish temple, you know, along there, St. Mary's.
I'm trying to remember where the city limit line is there.
About there.
So, and then this 3,500 GPM, you know, Park City has communicated that their surplus. I've heard Clint say they're essentially at 80% of their build out, which is interesting that they're just about there. And they think their existing portfolio can get them to build out.
Could this interconnect deliver into the old community water system, into, you know, Mountain Regional?
There's certainly a number of different ways to connect Summit Water to Mountain Regional closer to this interconnect, and the most logical one is probably very close to Old Ranch Road. So again, this would go to kind of Corey's point. We've got like two overlapping neighborhoods right there, almost Willow Creek, where that'd be my. And that was actually evaluated as part of Bone Collins' work, you know, with our input. That's probably the best spot to do an interconnect if we wanted to add an additional Summit to Mountain Regional interconnect as part of this project or in that area.
And those are what, 6-inch lines in the neighborhood? Or?
No, it's probably a mixed bag. But yeah, I mean, there's certainly at least 8. But at just like a very conceptual level,
right?
Trying to minimize cost to the district. It's a logical place to at least.
That's the closest area to get into our access zone.
That's another.
Is what's the grade line in this pipe?
That's another great point from Brian. So I don't know the HDL from Park City side.
Is it coming to Summit? Which Summit tank is it going to? Is it going to the Colony? It's not.
Our tank at the Colony?
No, it's not to the Meadow. No.
I think it goes to the Ranch Place tank.
Yeah, and if you want to see that design report, Mike, just let me know. Happy to, we can share it with you for sure. Yeah, you probably know Summit System better than I do. I'm sure you do. So, but yeah, to Brian's point, the other big benefit of having the interconnect closer to Old Ranch is that's way less pipeline for us to. Get around our Old Ranch booster pump station, around that zone break, and into our Atkinson zone. Because essentially, the Silver Springs part of the system is just kind of on an island, or a sinking island. It's the lowest HEL of the whole system. Whereas the Atkinson zone is a little bit higher, and it can essentially serve as a hub to get water anywhere else in the district. So we want to get the water on the Atkinson side. That would be operationally critical, probably, for any significant.
Just mend out Old Ranch Road to the suction side.
Yeah, we already have a line as part of an energy savings project. That was one of the first projects when I came on. So we have a line from the suction side, or the low pressure side, Atkinson side, running from Old Ranch to the Willow Creek neighborhood. Because previously we used to pump water from Old Ranch up to the bottom of the Colony at the White Pine Tank,
right,
and feed that back down to the Willow Creek neighborhood. So we put this pipeline in the ground to shift that demand, which has a number of benefits. And one of those, it could be potentially timeless.
Yeah.
And connect together and save a lot of money. But, I mean, it's all, you can put more pipe in the ground. It's just, it's a good spot to run down if we ever wanted to. But there's no plans to do so currently. Danny's not. So anyways, you do all the numbers.
We're good on water. It'd be more of resiliency and a backup kind of idea.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea.
Okay.
Yeah, and we do have, from an emergency perspective, there is an additional interconnect between Mountain Regional and Summit in that area. It's just certainly not sized to truck 1,000 GPM, you know, over an irrigation season. And that's located kind of up in the canyons area. I have no idea what that thing would rip. I mean, Andy and Brian would know better than I would. But
it's up under Grand Summit.
And that's an interconnect between, to your point, community water and Summit. That's up. It's quite a ways up the hill.
It's right next to the Grand Summit.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. You guys probably know that.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to hijack you.
That's a good question. That's the whole point. This isn't much of
it. So what's same as presenting here is part of the broader discussion about the treatment plan. Kind of this is a follow-up to some of the comments that were made at the last board meeting. And why leveling the treatment plan and starting over is not feasible based on these numbers. So we've gone through the SOQ process with two engineering firms, and both engineering firms were asked, do you believe we would be better off leveling the treatment plant and starting over, or do we have the bones that we can build on? And both of them said that you have a financial asset of $6 million on our books that you would be throwing away if you were to level the treatment plant. And if you were to level the treatment plant versus trying to better what you have, the quality of water is going to be no better by leveling and starting over. So they both feel like there's benefit in doing in taking what we have and improving on it. So we are in the process of working through a scoping work with Corollo. So if there's any members of the board that would like to participate in that scoping, we invite you to that, and we will do that scoping before we can actually enter into a formal contract, because they need to know what we expect. We need to know what their expectation is. And so, like I say, we invite you to do that, and we'd like to do that within the next couple weeks.
Yeah. And then, well, thanks for extending that invitation.
I think it'd be great to get the input. It's like the perfect time to do it. It'd be a good format. I think the Corollo team would be good to work with in that aspect. But sorry, just quickly wrapping this up. So anyways, you do the math, build out. It's a big deficit. The Weber Basin sees this big deficit on paper 5 years out to the regional leadership. That triggers them to act. That's the big project. That's like the $250 million project. Obviously these are all rounded numbers, like within a few percent. And it looks like we're almost cooking the books here, but essentially the amount of water that's available, raw water that's available via Lost Canyon, like today with existing water rate and pump station, but we can't treat it, is 2,000 GPM.
But we could with phase two.
Yeah. It'd be in. So that would essentially, you know, that's what we're showing in our master plan. We're essentially getting close to or meeting our build-out demands with that existing raw water allocation. This includes the original project water that was part of the original Weber Basin, you know, the federal the water rights through the our long-term leases, you know, the federal water that founded the whole Lost Canyon project. And then also we have an additional about 1,000 acre feet of water rights that were diversified down to the shallow wells as part of efforts in the past from Doug and previous leadership. So anyways, you add all those things up, take out what you think the golf courses are going to use, have Mountain Regional's allocation. What's left that we can't currently treat on peak days is about that 2,000 number. So again, this isn't perfect, but...
What was the golf courses part?
Well, I thought, and this is getting a little bit in the weeds, but when I really did a deep dive into how much water was available via the Lost Canyon system, you know, things were told me verbally a lot in the past, but going through and reviewing the agreements, there's how much water right you're allocated to, how much we are required to deliver to promontory, and then how much of that water can be raw water and not actually treated. How much can we get out of the treatment plant? Because in my perspective, anything that we can keep raw is a benefit to everybody, you know, environmentally, you know, financially, et cetera. So we have good data on how much water the golf course uses on its golf courses. We can project that out, knowing how many irrigated acres they have at this new proposed course they're bringing on. We don't have great data there yet, unfortunately. But anyways, we take that out of the pie of water we want to treat. So that is not included in that 2,000.
Right, because what can they put on? I used to figure a million gallons a day on a golf course. Is that? And if it's
I actually think that's probably a good number, but I also know the new golf course is only, I think, 30 acres of turf, which is much smaller than the two courses that were already existing.
Yeah, totally.
Is that a million gallons a day if we've got a 6 million gallon a day plant? That's a big deal.
Yeah, so what Nick course takes 700 GPM 24/7. Right, Bri?
Yeah, not necessarily 24/7, but that's a good thing.
It's a million gallons. The die core sticks, million gallons is a great number. The die core sticks a little bit less than that. And yeah, to your point, Karen, the best I could come up with for projections, we got a lot of different projections from the planners at Promontory, and I kind of struggle with that, but the best I came up with is like, how many acres are you actually irrigating here? How many are you currently? And it's 30 new acres, to your point, and they have 250 existing acres. Scale that up. That's what I'm using for our projections. Okay. So anyways, the current raw water allocation today is not much different from what it'll look like at build out potentially. Okay. There has been talk with Promontory about them installing, and well, actually we're just totally getting the weeds on. That's the big picture.
And what I got out of the big picture was that if the regionalization works out well at build-out, we may be able to avoid the big importation project.
Yeah, we show it on paper. Show it to Weber Basin. Yeah, I think it'd be hard to argue that's not in the paper. You know, I'm not a resident of the basin. You know, I don't live up here, but I would think if I was, that's something
big time.
I would... Yeah, I won't want to be a part of.
Now that Park City has to treat all that mine water, we've got a lot more in the basin.
Yep.
And so if we can avoid a $250 million, quarter billion, whatever dollar importation project, then that benefits everybody who lives in the basin.
Totally. So and if we ever show, Mountain Range ever shows this deficit to Weir Basin, then we're
But we would be able to erase that deficit with our current timeline of treatment plan. We wouldn't ever show that big a number because it wouldn't get that big before we got the treatment plant going.
That would be a good idea.
That would be a good idea. Okay.
And we wouldn't have to make sacrifices like getting rid of the pretreatment stuff.
No, we're maintaining our same levels of service, water quality, etc. Yeah. And then, just I know the pretreatment stuff came up. I could touch on that really super briefly and have you talk about it more, but I think I kind of made a mistake previously. We had the Corolla folks come in, kind of do an audit of sorts. And I tried to pull out some things I thought were interesting just to present to the board. But none of those things are necessarily like a direction the district is going. And obviously we have a ton of work over the next, year, multiple years to figure out what those are. And, those will be proven out at the bench. We'll make like data-driven sound decisions there with anything at that treatment plant. And then this is kind of the least useful thing. This is just a reminder. We kind of already talked about this.
That's my favorite one.
You like this?
Yeah, that's the best one.
It's the only one I understand.
Yeah, I know.
So again, this is what was in the master plan. We've talked about it a bunch. The blue line is the demand predictions. The blue line has no duty factor, however you want to think about it, with our groundwater sources. So it assumes our groundwater sources are ripping at 100% of their capacity in perpetuity. That's why we have this nice, perfect blue rectangle here.
Did you pull out the Silver Spring?
Yes.
Yep, it's not in there anymore.
And then again, the red line is the recommendation, like a goal to get to. And obviously, this includes a 20% safety factor or an 80% duty factor on our groundwater sources.
Right.
Historically,
PFAS and resting lows.
Yeah, or we just can't pump a well 24/7, even hydraulically. A tank's gonna fill up. But obviously, we can't get to red short term. It's not realistic, so it's a good, as the BCA folks, when they came and presented, like, it's a good goal to aspire to, and long term we can get kind of maybe back up to this red line, if that's ends up being a priority for the district. But yeah, just the point is, here's where we are now. Here's what's coming. Here's a wild guess on point A to point B.
And the black dots are actual, right?
Yep.
2020 high.
Black dots are actual usage. So yeah, the basis of this projection is we take the 2020 numbers, which is the high point in the district's production, not per capita or PRC, but just overall production, regardless how many connections we have. And then that becomes the ceiling, again, per ERC. So we take 2020 numbers, how much water does each ERC use, equivalent residential connection? That becomes the ceiling. We apply conservation on that and project that forward. So on the conservatism in this projection essentially is that we'll never go back to water behavior. Customers will never use water like they did in 2020 or previous years. So that's kind of, it's used as, I kind of think of it as like a ceiling in the projection. And then again, the dashed line, we take our conservation goal off of that. Or the red line if you want to look at it.
And the drop in the blue and red line?
Summit water.
Is summit water coming off right before 2025 or in 2025? The end of
it? Sorry. That's all I put together.
Thank you.
And yeah, if there's any follow-ups or anything I can do, Mike, I can definitely get you that interconnect study. If you want some more details on that 224 interconnect.
Okay. Great.
Great. Thanks, Sam. Steve, did you want to run us through the financials?
Yeah, sure. Sam, any chance you could pull those
up? Oh, sorry, Steve.
No, that's good.
Five?
Yep, that should be it. So far this year, we're doing better than budget. Our revenue is $350,000, more or less, above budget. The expense is about $60,000 below budget. The budget, the revenue is higher, kind of if you go down to the next little graph, that might be the easiest to see right there. Some from water sales. The Utah Olympic Park took about twice as much water as they usually do. So we had about a $30,000, $40,000 bump there. So that really helped. Also, the Park City, which school? I said it in there.
Carly's Park.
I was going to say that right. Paid an impact fee of about $115,000. So we got off to a good start on our impact fee budget. So that's why we're over on development related collections. And other revenue, I'd started to scale in rate drop, but as you probably know, the Fed has not cut rates yet. So we're still earning over 5.4% in our PTIF. So that's kind of where the revenue, a little bit in water sales, a lot of that was kind of the Olympic Park, then development-related collections and interest earnings.
What was the Parley's Park?
$115,000. They're doing a big addition, so the impact fee for the school.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So that was a nice start. Because we did about $188,000 of impact fees in January, and then we did about $17,000 in February. So...
are we going to get some more impact fees from some of the other
schools?
Yeah.
Trailside is slated for this year, too. That's the last one.
Okay.
Yeah, that's on. Yeah.
Did we pick stuff, and we picked stuff up for Jeremy, I'm assuming, and Treasure. Or no, Treasure's, no.
Yeah, and I was thinking Trailside. Summit does one side of the street, we do the other side of the street.
Which side is Trailside on?
Ours? They do Basin Rec, we do the school.
Sure, of course we do.
Can we make a connection there?
That'd be a good spot.
Go ahead and go down to the next graph or table. So operating expenses, we're operating, you know, just a little under budget right now, which is a good sign. You'd rather be under a little to start than start over. But yeah, no big trends yet in that. We're just kind of going to let that play out, but at least we're under for right now. The cash position, one thing I do want to mention, Sam, if you don't mind the next table down, sorry, is as you can see, we've added the money from the money we borrowed to build the buildings in, still earning good interest.
our cash, our 6.6 current month kind of available versus last year at 8.4. Again, we finished a lot of capital projects. The one thing that's going to happen this month is we've gotten approval from drinking water to move some of our capital facility reserves from reserves into unrestricted cash that basically we can use for about $1.1 million. So that'll be transferred next week.
Who gave permission for that?
Once we have to put 5% of our operating budget in a reserve.
Who requires that?
Drinking water.
The division. It's in our
It's in our bond documents with them because of the bonds we've had with them. So they just want to make sure you're putting money aside for
the bond. The money we owe them.
Yeah, well, we borrowed money, and one of the conditions of borrowing the money is that we would put some of our operating budget into a reserve every year to keep infrastructure up. And so when we finish projects, like, for example, this is paying for the Summit Park line and one of the wells we kind of brought back to life. We submit what we paid, and then they say, yeah, go ahead and we clear this with them before, too. And then they say, okay, yep, go ahead and you can use reserves for that. So that's where it can come back out of that 5%, and we can use it for, can't be new stuff. It has to be repair and replace kind of stuff.
You guys do so much work.
Yeah.
That's, like, really complicated.
Thank you. So, anyway, so that'll help improve our, let's say, unrestricted cash position a little. All right. Let's go ahead and go down. Customer growth. So far for January and February, we had 14 requests for new connections. Last year, we'd only had 5. So that's a little better than last year. We do have the $212,000 of impact fees received already. Again, over half of that was from one. Promontory has sold 5 lots compared to 3 last year. So maybe a little bit of a recovery, but we're still kind of close to 2023 numbers as far as future growth. All right. Let's go ahead and go down to usage. So in the lower purplish color on the far left, you'll see that through 2024 so far we've used 151 acre feet. For 2023 it was 150 acre feet. So basically usage is right at the same as it was last year. So even with growth, usage is very similar. You'll see the Olympic Park where they had taken 34 acre feet this year. Last year they'd only taken 14 or 13 the year before. So that was that unexpected. They made a lot of snow again in January or whatever they were doing.
That makes the 151 even more impressive.
Yeah. Well, the 151 is truly just our customers cut out.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah,
these are cumulative that way, standalone columns.
Can we expect that going forward, given that they just added 3 times as much terrain?
I think in the future we'll probably plan on more of that. But it was also, it came at a weird time, because usually, well, at least last year, nobody was making snow in January. We had plenty naturally. Mm-hmm. So you can't really, they usually make November, December.
They cut in that new ski run, so that's what that snow was, and they had that FIS or whatever they had up on the ski hill.
And they're going to cut more, aren't they?
They're going to do more up there. And one of the things that they had done was they drilled their own well that they thought was going to give them 300 gallons a minute, and it's 100. It's about a third of that.
Is that online?
Yeah.
So with that well, because that was drilled like last fall, right?
Yes.
So that came on and they still took 34?
Yes.
So they got additional water and they took 34 instead of
40. Yeah, because, I mean, they're blowing, you know, 2,200 gallons a minute. They're only able to produce 100 gallons a minute, so they had to make up that deficit somewhere. And, you know, Colin just was thinking he had this genie in the model and it didn't happen.
Pretty optimistic, Colin.
That's our conversation earlier. I mean, those compartments like in the 100, 200 gallon range, not 1,000.
We've been encouraging the Olympic Park for several months, year, to have a water master plan developed for them. I'm going to keep pushing.
He said he was going to look at me. Phone told me. He said, I'm going to look at you. They're planning on putting a hotel up there.
And a gondola.
Well, They're not going to be able to afford a gondola unless the county puts in a gondola.
My guess is Vail will put in a gondola to buy UOP, but that's just speculation.
Vail is required under the canyon development agreement to put a gondola from the canyons and connect to UOP. But they have not done that so far. I think part of the reason is because there isn't anything after the UOP for the gondola to go to. But it's all about money.
Huh. So when do you think that's going to happen?
When Vail would,
if they're contractually obligated to put that gondola in, is there a time frame on it? Or
there's just, not.
Sometime in the next 10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good call.
How'd you come up with that number, Corey?
That's the math.
If there's somebody that's going to pay for it.
Then our revenue, you can see in January that snowmaking kind of had that blue dot start a little higher than I would have anticipated. And then you see in February it's kind of back where I would expect just from our rate increase in growth, that it's a little bit higher, but pretty close. And then we'll see how that goes. As you all know, it all just matters what happens in the summer. Our budget for February versus actual came out pretty tight, about $12,000 over. Some from residential, lost a little industrial, commercial, and so forth, but still a pretty good estimate for what we do in February. The shoulder months are easy to predict. It's the summer months where we can have big swings. So, but everything's off to a good start.
Awesome.
So, all right, that's it. Unless there's questions or comments.
I was going to ask how much Summit Water can take, but it's 700 acre feet, right?
I said that, and all of a sudden I'm wanting, because...
I think it's five.
Is it five this year? This was the first year we have the drop, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah,
so
as soon
five,
as I...
five, and then zero in 2026?
Yeah.
So it's 400 settlement, 100... Nine,
the last year.
And then...
Yeah. All right. Oh, an audit update. The auditor is coming up next Wednesday. As you recall, Dana's doing it one last year. She can bid again if she wants, but she's coming up Wednesday. So, going along well.
Great.
Okay.
Let's see. So, Lisa, you're up.
Can you just bring up that 6A, Sam? So, since we adopted our drought response plan in 2021, annually in April, we ask the GM to provide a drought response level recommendation. Ahead of that April meeting, I thought I would just give you a sense of, we all know where we're at. We're having an above average year, and it's excellent, and it's very exciting to have two good years back to back. But I sit in on a monthly water update, supply update, and so I threw in some of the slides just for you to have a look at where we are, where we think we're going to be. Currently, it's all really good news. This is a seasonal temperature outlook and seasonal precipitation outlook. For the next 3 months, March, April, May, looks a little bit above average and equal chances either way on the precipitation. We did hear Jordan Clayton talk and Glenn Merrill at the Utah Water Users this week. So it looks like, and maybe you've looked at the weather, we're heading into an active weather pattern next week. And it looks like from his models, there's not a lot of high pressure really even up off to our north and west. So this active pattern should persist for the next few weeks anyway. So it was good news to kind of end March and head into April. If you go down to the next page, Sam. This is the snowpack currently for the full state of Utah. That's the black line is where we are right now. That green is average, so you can see we're above average currently. trending in the right direction. The right side just has a percent snowpack, snow water equivalent in each region there. That has since, that was the beginning of the month, that has since turned more blue. Blue being higher percentage of average, so that green, southern Utah had a nice system go through last week. So those greens are actually blues now. So almost all of the state are in those blue above average percentiles. Move down to the next slide. This is just the Weber Basin drainage, so you can see we're generally trending in that same area, and the average, I expect that to tick up a little bit more with the storm systems that we're seeing at the end of March, with our midpoint being there where that X is, generally the beginning of April, first or second week. Go down a little bit more, Sam. Soil moisture, another really good story here. Our soil moisture is in excellent condition. Again, looking really 90th, 100th percentile on that green for a lot of the state. Blues would be above, as I mentioned before, the south in those yellow where below percentile areas have ticked up. So soil moisture looking really good for runoff. And go down a little bit more. Reservoir totals, current statewide is 83%. Last year we were at 52%. Which is just really good, really, really good news. That does not include Lake Powell. And I think Flaming George is also excluded. But I just drove by, we all drove by. Jordanelle, but
Deer Creek.
It is full. This says 97%. It's 97%.
Wow.
And Jordanelle is in the 80s, I think. So. And we haven't even started to, just starting to barely melt out. So Smith Morehouse is low. So some of those yellows are just management, for this time of the year to start to let the water.
Why wasn't Flaming Gorge in the stat?
I think for a long time they were using that to supplement Lake Powell. So they took it out of the data because it was more, wasn't really a true representation of where it was. I think it is actually high though now.
I think it's back up. It's in blue one.
It's in blue, yeah. But they still excluded because they were in this graph, I think. And then down a little bit more, I think this last one is just the drought where we currently sit, looking good as far as drought conditions. So yellow's a little bit on the eastern side and the south, but I don't expect that to change dramatically over the next month when we would be looking at our drought response level. I'd expect our recommendation to be normal like last year. Don't think that will change. I won't say 100%. We are meeting with Weber Basin on Tuesday for a customer, water agency meeting. So we'll be getting updates from them on, I'm sure, drought response, conditions, reservoir levels, similar to what I'm kind of giving you here. We did get some information from them today, or Steve did, on some water rate increases that we will be seeing over the next 4 to 5 years?
4 years. They usually send us 2 years in advance so you can kind of start to budget. But because of the rate increases they knew were coming out, they sent it out a little earlier. So our increase to next year is about 2.5, then it goes to about 5, then it goes to like 7, and then the last year is an 8% rate increase. So we will have to kind of make sure we build that in, because in my modeling it's been at about a 4.5% increase. So it's going to be a little bit more coming from them. Obviously, some of that passes through to other parties. But yeah, it's the first time when, I don't know if you recall, but we kind of looked at it last year, and they've been pretty consistent, like 2.5% increases. But the letter, aging infrastructure, inflation, kind of the same things we're going to hear everywhere. But so they are going to start passing some more costs through.
So we'll have a formal recommendation and approval in the next board meeting.
Okay.
Great. A legislative update. I had put a report in the packet with just some updates to the original report that I had in March or February. And I did, Sam, if you go, I just had a couple that I wanted to touch on that passed in the very bottom up there. There's a PowerPoint presentation, slide deck for Ledge. I'll just run through some of them that passed and some of them that were more interesting this legislative session. We had House Bill 11 originally started with a 20% landscape minimum or maximum that could be on government and state buildings. That got reduced down to, oh, thanks, Sam. No overhead spray irrigation. So you just can't put overhead spray irrigation unless it's in an active recreation area, such as a sports field, amphitheater, social gathering area.
And cemetery.
And cemetery. Active recreation area. So UDOT can't put overhead spray in medians, or you can't have overhead spray in any kind of other government, you know, outside of your building or something if you if it's not an active recreation area. So that did pass. Utah Waterways Amendment, I thought this was kind of interesting. There is a collaboration now between Utah Waterways, which Tage Flint now heads up, and that was kind of the formerly our Conservation Slow the Flow campaign, with the State Board of Education to create some standards for education in water in K-12 for water cycle, watersheds, how we protect water quality, etc. They did have a sub that said we need that the language needed to make sure the standards did not include information on human caused climate change. So that's interesting. So that cannot be taught. Next, Utah Water Amendments House Bill 275. This was good. This says that HOAs or CCRs related to those HOAs may not require lawn. That's no longer going to be allowed. This was kind of a bill that included a bunch of stuff, but one of the other things they were trying to clean up who can receive grant money on some of that secondary irrigation installations that are happening that need to be completed by 2030. House Bill 280 was a really, really big bill that obviously you can see it has five subs. It had a lot of information in it, and there's still a lot of studying I think they need to do about do with it. It did, however, bring up this new way that they're talking about funding water infrastructure projects, which would come with a annual infrastructure plan that would be submitted by relevant agencies, DWR, Division of Drinking Water, Water Quality, etc. And then they will submit these to a new council called Utah's Water Development Coordinating Council, which would be made up of reps from those agencies, plus Housing and Community, Treasurer's Office, Department of Ag and Food, and an individual appointed by the governor, who would then develop a unified water infrastructure plan. That unified water infrastructure plan is... will use a ranking and prioritizing methodology, which has not yet been described, to be studied and understood how that will happen. This bill also, it did create a water infrastructure fund, which is how these water projects would get completed. There's a lot of talk, and I don't think anybody was ready at this point to try to say how that was going to be funded. So that got pushed into a study, and they've asked the Division of Water Resources to study with a recommendation due by October what that funding mechanism looks like. You know, we're talking about basically passing some of these things on to, or, you know, a tax, if you will. Is it a tax? Is it a fee? And depending on this ranking and prioritizing of projects, does this maybe not benefit smaller communities, benefit larger communities? So I think there's a long way to... there's a lot to work out here. Snyder was running this bill, and I think he understood that there's a lot to understand here, a lot to unpack as far as how you're going to do that. So we'll see how it goes. They've at least put some guidelines in place on how they'd like to do it, but there's still a lot to be done here. Next slide. There's House Bill 453 is a really big bill about lots of things related to the Great Salt Lake. They are trying to put in, not trying to, they are now tasked with creating a Great Salt Lake Management Plan that's going to be done by the state engineer to try to understand the water rights that are that these entities are using and water they're extracting off the Great Salt Lake and related to some of these mining and metals extractions. So they need to put a plan together there. Senate Bill 211, probably some of you heard about this. This was the generational water infrastructure amendment. It was run by Stuart Adams and the House Speaker, Mike Schultz, so it was pretty much going to get passed. It creates another council. This one will be called the Water District Water Development Council, which will be led by the GMs of the four largest water conservancy districts and the director of the Division of Water Resources. They'll be tasked with planning and infrastructure with a 50 to 75 year lens. And they will report to the governor and the legislature annually on what that looks like. They will be exempt from GRAMA and Open Public Meetings Act. So what they discuss will not need to be noticed. You can't GRAMA it. And you can't hear about it until they go to the legislature. Creates a new state officer, the Utah Water Agent, which is appointed by the governor, approved by the Senate and the state. They will represent Utah in interstate negotiations related to getting water into the basin, potentially, in these longer time frames. If there is water in other states, I don't know. They'll be in a six-year term, and they're basically assuming responsibilities that had previously been assigned to the Board of Water Resources. They were appropriated $3 million in a one-time funding, and they will be receiving $1 million annually for this kind of work. Yes, so stay tuned. lots of talk here, a lot of people in opposition because of the privateness, I guess, and the lack of transparency that's potentially going to be happening here. Their comments back in response to that were, we need to be able to have these ideas and nurture these little seedling ideas and not have a bunch of scrutiny on us while we're doing it, is what I heard in the meeting. So they said, don't worry, we will bring all of our information to the legislature. We cannot own assets, buy assets, dictate policy. Nothing will happen. It will have to go to the legislature before any policy changes are approved. But there will be conservancy districts with Division of Water Resources and this new Utah Water Agent going out proactively looking at these long-term generational infrastructure type projects that we, the public, won't really have visibility to until it comes before the legislature.
Who are the four largest?
Weber Valley, Jordan Valley, Central Water, and
Washington.
Metro.
It's St. George's, Washington.
Washington and the Metro. There's five big ones.
There's five. But it's just the four biggest.
I don't know.
Which one am I missing?
Somebody's being left out.
Weber.
Probably.
Metro.
Jordan.
Washington. Jordan. What about Central Utah?
Yeah, Central Utah.
Central Utah. Yeah. Hmm. Interesting. The next slide.
Sorry, Amy.
It's okay.
Yeah, we don't make that cut.
A lot of the bills that didn't pass, I think there was a lot of talk about just continued conservation, 20% lawn, and reducing the time that people can water, restricting the dates on which people can water. I think that the legislature really didn't have an appetite for telling folks what to do. There were some asks for monitorizing optimization efforts. That was kind of a theme on, okay, we're asking for all these optimization efforts, but how are we measuring that and being able to explain and report on what those findings are? That was House Bill 448, Water Usage Amendments, to have the Division of Water Resources do that. That was not passed. There was another bill, 472, which asked for one central water database and one data center where everyone goes to gather information because it's fragmented and in different areas. And, it wanted a study to kind of say, what could we do and how could we get that information into one central location so that we're all talking about the same thing. No, that wasn't, no appetite for that. Water there was another interesting that was the water conservation modifications. That was just kind of again talking about, okay, we're conserving all this water. Is it making it to the Great Salt Lake? What's working? What isn't? No appetite for that next one.
Because we're not monitoring.
Yeah, because we're not really. We don't have the ability to. Yep. So there was a House Joint Resolution I thought was really interesting. This was encouraging water efficient landscaping ordinances for new construction. It was not mandating. It was not saying you must do it. It was just encouraging municipalities and counties to adopt water-efficient landscape standards, and they said no. So what else? Water efficiency amendments, again, trying to get developer incentives to giving developer incentives to try to do low water landscapes, no. Golf course amendments, that was interesting. Makes water-related data on golf courses protected against grammas, so you cannot find out how much golf courses are using on their water. And that didn't go. There was also a thought of studying what state-owned golf courses are using and potentially reporting on, and that didn't go. So Senate Bill 203 is another interesting one related to fees. The Department of Environmental Quality, this bill is essentially trying to get them fee authority in order for them to establish and implement an annual fee on public water systems. So instead of the legislature giving Division of Drinking Water money to help fund a lot of times they were talking specifically related to technical and assistance to water systems.
Staffing,
really. It's like, you know, at 5 to 10 FTEs, I get it. I mean, it's a lot of work. Yeah. So they're, instead of asking the legislature for more money, I think they're also going to be running out of some federal money that they had. They wanted to kind of push that feedback on water systems, which would mean us, which would mean we would then push it down to our customers. So that is it. That did not pass, but I could see that coming up again. The fee is pretty small. They did a calculation. A median annual fee would be like $2.11 per connection. But that was not passed this session. I imagine it will come back again. And some of the other bills that were not necessarily water related, you can go to the next one, Sam. Local government bond amendments. This was really just related to lease revenue bonds, not necessarily the revenue bonds that we would be issuing, but an interesting concept nonetheless, that this would prohibit doing lease revenue bonds if it were over a certain dollar amount, $200 million over a three-year period, and you would they're limiting it, and it has very specific noticing requirements that will come with it.
It's a lease revenue bond.
So this is when, you can maybe help me out here, Dave. I think this is what Wasatch School District did.
This is lease revenue bonds are when you form a local building authority. It's a device basically to get around an election with a general obligation bond. But it's one that's been used for 50 years. So you create a local building authority who owns the property, and the building authority is just the alter ego of the governmental entity who created it. And so what happens is the local government enters into a lease with the local building authority who owns the land that they're going to build this building on, and technically speaking, you know, the building authority is going to own it. So the lease is that, you know, the governmental entity wants to use the building that the local building authority is building, so it leases it, and that becomes the income stream in order to float a bond. And
guaranteed.
Yeah, so basically, it's a bond that has these lease payments as the revenue stream for the local government to go out and borrow money.
The lease secures the bond.
Yeah, the lease secures the bond, and I think Senator Fillmore, I think, thought that there were local governments who were overly taking advantage of this type of a bond. And so he wanted to put some limits on it.
Let's see which one was I wanting to talk about. Is that our, not post-retirement, oh, the Utah Retirement Systems Amendments. They ran a bill this year because starting in July 1st, 2024, the government employees that are participating in the Utah Retirement System that are in the Tier 2 system will now be required to contribute 0.7% of what normally is funded by Mountain Regional Water. We've hit the cap. We've hit the 10% cap is what has happened. So this year when they've made their calculations, they've gone over that 10% cap, and this bill that they put forth said, let's raise that cap a little bit so that employers can pick up that 0.7% and it doesn't necessarily get pushed down to the employees. That did not pass. And based on my understanding, what I've heard through other human resource channels and the like, is that the legislature wasn't interested in increasing benefits at this point. They would rather have any kind of adjustments made on the salary side. So what the state of what I've heard the state of Utah is doing is they will be doing a 0.7% increase to folks in that Tier 2 pension system to help accommodate for that 0.7% that they will now be having to contribute on their own. So in addition to their normal 3%, you know, rate increase, they will get a 3.7% rate increase, or compensation increase. But that was interesting to me because this had come up before in the Tier 1 system when they had hit their cap, and in a legislative bill, they just simply upped the cap. And this was, I can't remember. Maybe Dave, you remember what year it was. It was earlier in 2000. But this time, when the Tier 2 system hit it, the legislature said, no, we're going to leave the cap where it is, and we'd rather just have, you know, the employees participate in 0.7%. So that's what we'll be doing. Unless something changes between now and July 1st, our employees in that system will need to start contributing 0.7%.
And that's based on when they join the district? Sorry.
Yeah.
Right.
Your tier.
The other,
your tier.
Other thing, too, is it's a post-tax
yes.
contribution as opposed to a pre-tax.
Okay.
So if you get a 0.7% raise, it's not really going to help you. Like,
it won't cover it all.
It won't cover it all.
Yeah, basically, the state's not fully funding the pension from you have to partially fund your pension a little bit now. Mm-hmm. At least for a year.
At least on election day. Maybe I think that was all I had. And then the last one, Sam, is just the backflow administrator 6C. So this does require an action, and this change is, in 2022, we started with this backflow administrator job description. This was a new job description for the district. We hadn't had anything like this before. Stacy in customer service had kind of been, you know, and doing it, but as we grew and as the number of connections grew, we needed to kind of nail down that position. So we've done that. And as you know, Stacey went to project coordinator, manager, and John stepped into this role. And so the job has continued to evolve a little bit. And as we looked at pay grades and job descriptions for this position, we had a few tweaks that we wanted to make. One of them being, it was initially approved at a 15. This work that this person is doing and the kind of, you know, growth we've seen in the district and what will continue to happen in the district with the institution of our new SWIFT Comply program. So we're taking it all to a really whole nother level, our backflow administrative program. We thought that that range should be increased a little bit. So it would be a change from a pay grade 15 to a 15-17. I've listed the ranges there. And then behind that, we had a few red lines on the job description. I think they were fairly, nothing too significant. John does do, and it has worked out that in that position really is kind of a floater a little bit too, to help with inspections or help with the other customer service folks that are in the field. So we wanted to recognize that in the position, that there is some time available to do that. That kind of works well.
Yeah, it looks like it was going from maybe 75% office, 25% field to more 50-50.
Yeah, it's more 50-50, definitely, in the office and out of the office. So, any questions on the red lines or the pay grade change?
And the major red lines at the end, did that come from?
So that was when we instituted the lead technician program. Mm-hmm. We used those new environments and those percentages. I think, well, they're all outside, but we use some of that work environment language, and we wanted to include that in the backflow.
Okay.
Since we did that, so we did that one pre the lead tech job description, so we wanted to just clean that up a little.
Looks familiar.
And was John an existing employee when he became the backflow administrator, or was he an outsider?
He was in the customer service department, just as a customer service technician. And so he moved into that backflow last year.
Cool.
Do we need to make a motion to?
Yeah.
Okay.
To approve. And David Warnock has reviewed and approved. He didn't have any comments or questions on the changes.
Was this a result of some just annual job description review, or?
Yeah, as we're looking at the end of the year, kind of where pay grades land, and with the lead tech pay grade changes and some of the manager changes, when we look at this position, it really was kind of an outlier. So when we were looking at the end of the year, it became a little bit evident that the pay grade was not in the right spot.
So there's no financial impact?
Yeah, this is
no just a straight clarification of the job description and the pay grades.
No change to the budget, no change to John's pay. It's just...
Okay. I move to approve the changes to the backflow administrative job description.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, it looks unanimous.
Thanks, Joel.
Thanks, Joel.
Thank you.
Great. Well, thanks, Lisa.
You're welcome.
Andy, you're up.
So I've sent you all an invitation to the groundbreaking on May 23rd at 2 o'clock. That's also the same day as our May board meeting. So we hope to schedule... We hope to flow one into the other and maybe not keep you as late into the night, as long as there's no public hearing that day. We are, the plans have been submitted to the county. They were submitted 3 weeks ago. We paid several impact fees. We didn't get friends and family discount from any of our co-special service districts.
Darn it.
We tried.
What about from us? Do we get to waive our own fees or no?
We won't charge you to come to the building.
Oh.
I don't think that's what she was asking.
Yeah, well, we could try. You build again. So that is moving along. They hope to actually mobilize on the site on April 15th. So there will be things that have happened on the site between now and our formal. But I think the weather will be better in May. Hopefully it will be drier. Won't be as muddy. But we'll be working with Oakland to put that together. The shop building has been ordered. If you remember, that's the steel, not a prefab, but a lot of it is pre-done. That should show up in June. Lisa really touched on a lot of the water conference updates, the legislative and the weather patterns that we're seeing. But one of the other things that was brought up is we are more apt to have drought than we are to have the conditions we've had for the past two winters. And and I can't remember how he said it, the known knowns. We know it is getting warmer. We know the population is increasing. We know that we need to continue conserving water, even though the reservoirs are full. We need to continue to do turf removal programs. We need to continue to change how we water. I missed one of the seminars where the farmers and were really ripping on the presenter on, you know, why do we need to do this? It's our water. The Great Salt Lake will live and things will move on. So it's getting heated. Although I won't be part of the Big Five or the Big Four, I am going to go to the Weber River Watershed Council on Monday. Doug Evans has asked me to step in and take his place on that. So that will be up at Weber Basin on Monday afternoon.
Step in permanently or just at that meeting?
Permanently.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah, Doug's trying to wind down.
I was guessing that. So. Okay.
Yeah. We'll see.
Yeah.
This is still.
Yeah. Poetry.
Yeah. Okay. That's all I have.
I'm going to poke some bear somewhere about the new office and shop. I can't remember how long ago it was, the last time I was out there, 2 or 3 weeks ago. There was still drilling and blasting equipment. Is anybody watching that from a cost perspective?
So, John Angel from the county, and I don't know if Steve Kendall is involved in that or not.
Mike Kendall is going to be involved with that, but we actually have a guy on site, Danny, that's kept his eye on all the blasting.
I'm just looking at it at this point as a concerned citizen, and I know that my role in my 9-to-5 job gives me probably a little bit too much bias, but it doesn't even pass the sniff test anymore. The amount of rock that's been moved out there is offensive. And if the county expects anybody here to pay for that contract that on surface, first blush, whatever you want to call it, looks as corrupt as hell. We need to fight it tooth and nail.
Well, I have a number from the county attorney that's firm, so...
I'm just saying it...
It certainly is more than we initially thought, but one of the things that we're also getting done in our site is they are excavating and backfilling our two foundation sites. They're blasting for future additions now. So we're having a little extra work.
It just looks so much like a sweetheart deal. It's sickening.
Yeah,
it is. I'm appalled every time I drive out there.
I'm not sure how it's a sweetheart deal. County's paying most of it.
But there's a contractor out there who's getting paid by the ton of dynamite.
Yeah, we renegotiated his contract.
But that's what I'm asking: is somebody here watching those costs? Because I don't, from my perspective, nobody else is. It doesn't look that way from the surface, anyway. It is just abhorrent.
You can be sure that the county personnel on site and Chris Robinson, particularly, has been more than involved in all the minutiae to make sure that we renegotiated the contract with them and we got a better understanding of from geotechnics at the site and what it's going to require.
Because what we're paying is certainly different than what High Valley is paying.
Certainly.
Because we don't have that same, we don't have the federal oversight, Davis-Bacon and all those other things, so that was renegotiated to a...
I'm just looking at a relatively flat project site that took them a year and a half to make a little bit flatter. And that's, from a construction perspective, having been in that industry my entire career, is...
Well, if you remember, we had a 13-foot mound that had to come down.
It didn't have to come down, is my point.
No.
Because so we have a fixed fee for the blasting for our facility.
I have a number from the county. And I can't remember off the top of my head. I could dig up tapes.
Yeah, I can't remember what it is.
It's more than we originally thought. But again, we are also getting some extra. So we were either going to have to pay a new contractor to come in and do it, or we just moved into the county's, piggybacked on the county's contractor, so we wouldn't have to pay a second MOAB fee and other things like that. So we're trying to be cost conscious where we are, and the construction numbers for our building are out, and those should be back next week. All I have.
Okay. Well, on to the first part of the fun stuff. We've got control board elections. So we need to vote for chairman, vice chair, audit finance committee chair. Everyone is on the audit finance committee, the conservation committee chair, and then we need two board members for the personnel committee. So,
I've done this in the past. We just kind of like, yeah.
Do we want to consider keeping everything the same? Is there anyone that wants to, you know, step up and do something different? Joel, do you have any thoughts down there in windy Florida?
No, not really. Whatever you need me to do, that's fine.
Okay, so currently I'm the chairman, Ian's the vice chairman, I believe I'm also the audit committee chair.
Yep.
Ian, are you the conservation committee chair?
I don't think I am.
Oh. Do we know who's
I can look it up.
I could be, I was in the past. And then I switched over to the personnel committee. And I wasn't here for elections.
Oh, that's last right. I missed you were it. In the Galapagos.
So they probably made you.
So that last year?
They probably gave you everything.
Joel and Mike were the personnel this past year.
Yeah.
You were the conservation chair.
I am?
Oh, did you?
Okay.
And Joel, personnel, audit and finance.
We're all on that. Okay.
Corey, do you have any interest in any committees?
Finance is not my forte, but sign me up for anything else that
you're on that one by default.
Filled.
It's okay. I take one for the team and I read the audit first.
Right.
I'd be fine staying in vice and willing to drop conservation if somebody wants to take it, but I'd also keep both roles if anyone wants the conservation.
It sounds very involved if you knew that you
missed last year
participating.
Actually, and then when I knew I was the conservation chair, I don't remember doing anything. Might have been one conversation during the conservation race when they came in, but
what were the duties?
You have to go out and when somebody violates it, you
Well, I never did that.
We all
I believe in defunding the HOA.
My recollection, we went through the conservation rate thing. The whole board participated in that. It wasn't like one person was leading those discussions. So.
Yeah, I don't think it's extremely involved. Just like I don't anticipate any big personnel committee issues, but when they come up, you know, it's always very important.
And personnel handles my review and brings it to the board.
Right.
So that's a big assignment.
There has been a big role there in the past when we've had like changes in leadership.
Yeah.
I mean, big time commitment on that.
The pay is the same with the exception of the chair.
You don't get an extra dollar.
That's right. I think I get an extra $50.
So why did I do Andy's review?
Because you're on the personnel committee.
That I was just looking at the website and it doesn't have me on that. personnel committee. I'm just audit and finance.
Does it list the people from the personnel committee?
It just lists the board members and their position.
We need to renege those.
Yeah, I'm looking Andy's at the minutes from last year, and I have Andy's you and Joel committee. As the two
we
members
to renege
of the personnel
on it.
Committee. So that's why we might just not have it listed.
I really enjoy being on the personnel committee.
All right, well, so Mike would like to stay on the personnel committee. How do you feel about the personnel committee, Joel?
That's a yes.
Yep. Was that a thumbs up?
Joel, can you hear us?
Yeah, well, I'm sorry, what did you say?
Oh, we were talking about the personnel committee. You were on last year.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine.
We're a good team.
Okay. So, what I'm hearing is Mike and Joel would like to stay on the personnel committee.
No.
The conservation committee could remain Ian, or Corey could jump into the fray and have his first committee assignment.
I'm happy to take it.
You are.
Ian just gave me the nod.
Thank you, sir. Considering I didn't even do anything last year.
I don't foresee anything this year.
Yeah, we'll set up.
Given the snowpack, it won't be
a full team by everything that happens.
Do we have any challengers on the chairman, vice chair, or the audit committee chair?
I
enjoy doing this, and
doing a nice job. I think everybody's happy with helping run. You do a great job.
Thanks, Mike. That's a lot coming from you.
And I think that's a position where there's benefit of like having a bit of tenure, you know.
Absolutely.
Continuing that on. I mean, once you've gotten, you know, familiar with all of that and leading all of it, so.
Okay.
Yeah. It takes a couple of years. Mm-hmm.
So maybe by this year I'll be good.
No, you're doing great already. So.
So I think someone just needs to make a formal.
Okay. So yes. So I think the motion would be to have me as the chair, Ian as the vice chair, me as the audit chair, everyone on the audit finance committee, Corey as the conservation committee chair, and then Mike and Joel, the personnel committee board members.
So moved.
Do we have a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, great. That's unanimous. Did I do that too fast? Did you get it all?
I think everything's the same except for Corey.
Yes, everything's the same except for Corey.
Yep.
Okay. So you could just say, yeah, everything the same except for conservation.
And then, okay. I guess, the heads up that, yeah, you weren't listed on the personnel committee on the website. So.
Yeah, I can have Chris add the personnel committee to Joel and Mike, or make sure. Does it say that?
It was not Joel, just
it
wasn't
is,
on
just
Mike.
Not Mike's? Okay.
It just wasn't on Mike's.
I'll send
yeah.
Chris an email right now. Thank you.
And he's going to have to do the other changes.
And
he'll
have to change Corey. Yep.
Yeah, I can change Corey.
Jackie or Kimber can do the changes too.
Yeah, we can have Corey. Okay.
Oh, you can do that? Mm-hmm. I don't have access.
She has the authority.
I have emails.
Nice.
Okay, and then we are on to our annual Administrative Control Board training with Dave.
What is that,
Thomas.
Mike?
You need a two-minute break, Mike?
I'm going to take a quick break.
Were there any questions on the department updates? I think we might have skipped one. But if anybody, maybe there.
Yes, we did have department updates. Did anyone have any questions? I did have a question for you, Lisa.
Okay.
Since we are looking at a WIFIA funding of $23 million, do we have any idea what kind of interest rate you might get on that?
So they tie that to the WIFIA. So we submitted an application. Well, we submitted a letter of interest for the funding, and we were awarded basically the federal government, the EPA has set aside funds for Mountain Regional. We were able to qualify for 80% of the amount, not 50%, because we're a small community. We just barely squeaked in. But it does, the rate would be tied to the Treasury, so right now it's, we would do a longer term, so we're, I think the other day when I talked to the EPA, we're at like 4.25 or something like that percent. But that does not lock in until you actually close the loan, which if we were, this is just an option. This is just something we were pursuing to see if this is something that may be possible for the treatment plant. We might want to go another route. We just wanted to see, is this something that we could even qualify for?
Sorry, bond council.
Yeah, and it's, and the nice thing about, I mean, federal money does come with, you know, it comes with some ties attached to it.
Right, if you have, like, Buy American.
Yeah, look, we would be able to, the BABA, the Buy America, we would be able to actually get a waiver for, because we initiated planning on this prior to May of 2022. Because we were working on this with Jacobs and Scott in 2021, the end of 2021. So the EPA, I've already told the EPA that. They said, okay, you're good. So it would be steel. We would have to do the American steel, and we'd have to do Davis Bacon. But what this does lend itself to is putting a really long time period on that money, where you wouldn't even... They're allowing, once you finish construction, you have a 5-year time period that you wouldn't even have to start making payments yet. So you have five years from the date of completion to start making payments, and then you have a 30-year window that they could go up to maximum life on the loan.
So you could go and be in construction for 5 years, then defer 5 years. Yeah, so the amortization, the interest rate's not as important as the amortization and our ability to kind of smooth this in from a rate increase. We think that even though there are some strings attached for the district, it's probably a good idea. And there's no restrictions. If they finance 80%, we can go seek other funding for the other 20%. They don't worry about subordinating or...
They'll take a second position. This money that the federal government has infused to try to get these water infrastructure projects completed, they're trying to be as flexible as they possibly can to try to get the money out there. I believe I did not actually, I will ask Weber Basin next week, I believe they've applied for funding, and I think they have a project that's currently going to be with you funded. I sat in on a call with I don't know, it was Colorado or Western States Region Division, and chatted with I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but a city in Colorado that's using it. And it's kind of cool because you can also do, if you have several projects with phases, you can kind of go under this one kind of master agreement, if you will, and then only pull the money when you need it on those phases, and there's no interest that starts accruing until you start pulling the money. So you could get awarded, you know, sit on it for a little bit, and as soon as you pull, the interest doesn't start accruing until you start pulling the money. So, I mean, what I'm getting for it, while it does have some strings of tie, if you think of it as federal money there, they're really trying to be as flexible as they can because they want the money out there and they want to get these projects done that they feel like qualify under this, under their conditions for these types of loans.
And this money is set aside. It's not subject to the whim of the government where it could go away.
Yeah, it's already been earmarked for us. So it's just... The next step for us would be submitting the loan application, which will take some time. We'd have to do a NEPA review. We had federal money up there when we did. We got grant money to do part of the pretreatment process, I believe, at the district along
phase two,
mm-hmm. Right? So I wonder if there was a study done then. I don't remember. So there may be some synergy there because
if
we've already...
If Bob Bennett showed up to the grant, or when it opened.
Oh.
Yeah,
so we may already have something there. So this is, like I said, we're just starting to explore it. I'm starting to get into the loan application process, which can, you know, we have up to a year to actually do this. And, you know, we haven't even scoped the design yet. So... I think we're at a good spot, and I think the EPA said, you know, it's great that you've come in now because you've got time on your side to, you know, get, we're not in a rush, we're not like shovel ready, we got to get this money right now. And I think by the time we were looking at closing something, I think interest rates are going to come down.
Yeah.
So the timing could be good for putting some of this funding into use. Just an option we were exploring and wanted to see if we had any traction.
I love that you guys are on top of stuff like this. Who knew somebody had $23 million sitting around just waiting for us? You know?
It's nice. It's nice to try to... Well, and the floating solar array money, that just you got to just keep kind of pounding the pavement, if you will, a little bit, and seeing what works and what doesn't work.
Did anyone else have any questions on department updates? Okay, then let's jump into Dave Thomas.
Okay. Go ahead and do the PowerPoint one.
This guy.
Sam, you're doing great. You don't even notice that Chris isn't here.
Appreciate that.
Don't tell Chris.
Ouch! Okay. Go to the slide.
Okay. You want to drive?
Alright. See if this works. Maybe. So these are the topics. Special service districts generally. What your roles are. We're going to touch on Open Meetings Act because there's significant changes to the Open Meetings Act this last legislative session. Then just a shorter bit on liability and immunity. You already know that there are lots of special service districts, and there are 13 independent local districts that are service districts but are not special like you guys. The special service districts, sometimes refer to them as dependent districts because the county council is the governing authority, and they appoint all the members, the administrative control boards, to the special service districts. Whereas the independent local districts, most of them have elected boards of trustees. There are a number of them, specifically the cemetery districts, that are still appointed by the county council.
Are they all created by the county council, though? Yeah. Special and independent?
They're all created. So we've got 25 total districts, 12 special service districts, 13 local districts. Some facts, the services that special service districts provide, the ones that are in blue are the ones that are the biggest ones in Summit County. I've already said they're dependent districts. County Council's the governing body. They have delegated authority to administrative control boards, like yourselves, as well as to an executive officer, like your general manager. You're subject to the Local District Act and the fiscal procedures for local districts, that's your budgeting. Also, audit reports, the reason why I have to have an external audit each year. You're subject to the personal management system, merit system. And you're subject to the procedures that are in place for fees and charges, which is the reason why you have to have public hearings before you have rate increases. And you're subject to the UW Procurement Code. That's a different thing than cities and counties. And the UW Procurement Code can be somewhat unwieldy at times, but I think we got people who can maneuver our way through. There are certain non-delegable duties that the county council cannot delegate away by statute. One of them is annexations. The other is certain designated public works contracts. But those public works contracts, they're kind of a thing of the past. We actually don't do those kinds of public work contracts anymore. Taxation, you don't have a tax rate. But if you did, you would have to go through the county council. Obviously, all your bonds go through the county council. And there's the current county council for you. Their role is they appoint and remove you as members of the ACB. They also consent to the hiring and discharge of your executive officer. They require interlocal agreement, provide legal services, and sometimes HR services. They have the power to undelegate any power that they have given to the ACB. And they have done that with certain things like personnel. We operate under a letter of authorization for each of our districts. But that's the reason why, you know, in talking about, you know, your job description, Lisa mentioned she run it by David Warnock, who's the HR director at the county. The county council has taken back final approval of all the budgets, bylaws, policies, procedures, and regulations, although that might be changing. I think there is beginning to be a discussion at the county council about whether and what they want to be involved with. So personnel policies, yes, but there may be changes in the future having to do with operational policies and whether they're just going to allow the Administrative Control Board to approve those. That came up with the Centerville Basin Rec District yesterday, and they're going to have some continued discussions on that in 2 weeks. They've reserved for themselves eminent domain. If you're a recreation district, the purchase of real property or disposal of real property. With Mountain Regional, it's litigation.
It goes through the county.
Yeah, well, it goes through the, if you wanted to settle a litigation matter, it would go through the county council.
Okay. And the sale of this building, the control board can authorize that?
Correct. You're not a rec district. And that's mainly because of open space bond money. That's the reason that is. Funding and financing, you all probably understand. You run basically on fee-for-service and impact fees. Others have property tax. You have to have an election in order to impose a property tax. General obligation bonds and lease revenue bonds. Special service districts do not have the ability to have a sales tax. So you can't have sales tax bonds. Let's see. Here's some sources of funding of each of the special service districts so you can get an idea of what other districts do in terms of property taxes and other things. Your executive officer, he has a supervisory role over the department heads and other district officers. Personnel actions, controls and directs the prosecution of civil lawsuits or defense of civil lawsuits. But we've talked about how if you want to settle, you have to go to the county council because of the way that it's been structured. Andy can issue executive orders, and you keep the board updated on all the activities of the district.
I thought someone had veto power over those.
They do. We'll get to that.
Oh, sure.
Your financial role, for Andy is he's the purchasing agent. He can delegate that out, executes contracts. I approve as to form. He presents the budget to you, the proposed budget to you. He's your risk manager, so we would interface or delegate someone to interface with the Utah Local Government's Trust, applying for grants, approve other expenditures. Asset manager role, the big one here is exercising control of all assets in real property, develops the capital facilities plan, and implements the plan once it's been approved by the ACB and the County Council. And person disposes of real and personal property.
That's the veto that was that little asterisk there?
No, that's coming out. Okay. The veto's coming out.
But that said with the...
Yeah, that's for recreation districts.
Okay.
On property acquisition and disposal of real property. The liaison role, Andy is tasked with liaisoning with all these other independent governmental entities and generally acting as your PIO. Regulatory, it's Andy's job to enforce all the rules and regulations and policies and procedures within the district, signs off on plat approvals, custodian of all your minutes, acts as your district clerk, prepares these draft resolutions and policies and regulations for your review, resolves complaints that come in to Mountain Regional's office. He acts as either the grant officer or he appoints a grant officer. Have you appointed a grant officer?
It's Lisa.
Lisa, okay. And renews the registration for Mountain Regional with Lieutenant Governor annually. Administrative Control Board. The Little Manual for Local and Special Service Districts is a pretty good tool the state auditors put out. It's online. Your regulatory role is you recommend the bylaws, policies, and procedures, and regulations of the county council. You may be sitting in an appellate role to hear appeals as part of your policies and procedures. Recommending organization master plans to county council, and you attend these kinds of
organization master plan for the organization or
yeah.
Water master plan?
Both. Your financial role, district budget, you recommend that to county council. You recommend the capital facilities plan. That's the first half of the impact fees. But you are the ones that actually impose the impact fee. If you had a property tax, you would recommend tax levy to the county council and increasing taxation. You are in charge of making sure the financial performance audits are done through your audit committee. You have a general supervisory exercise over all the financial things that go on within the district. You recommend parameters resolutions to the county council if you're bonding for something. You set the fee structure. And you're supposed to provide approval of how the money that Mountain Regional has gets invested under the Money Management Act. Your supervisory role, you hire your executive officer, your general manager, with the consent of the county council, and you can veto any executive orders of Andy. You conduct his performance evaluation. You can discharge the executive officer, hire the executive officer. You can veto hiring decisions that Andy might make. If Andy wants to bring on somebody and you guys disagree, you can veto it. You serve as an appellate body on personnel actions. Ultimately, you can use the county's career service council if you need to. Important in terms of your supervisory role is you do not direct individual employees of the district. So if you have a problem with Lisa or anybody else, or Brian, if Brian didn't fix something right, you don't call Brian up, you call Andy up. And then Andy calls up Brian. So everything is through your general manager. You are the principal policymaker for the district, and you have that general oversight role. The important thing to understand is that there are five of you. The will of the board is expressed by a majority vote with a quorum present, and no statement or act of any individual member of the board can be viewed as the will of the board, because you act, like I said, three, magic number is three.
Say, for example, we have a meeting where there's just four board members present, and then it's a 2-2 vote. It's never happened, but...
It fails.
Okay, it has to be majority. Okay.
Has to be a majority.
And it's not like the tie vote or anything.
Correct.
Okay.
Want to go over Open Meetings Act because, well, because there are a lot of changes to it. This is what we're going to kind of go over. And if you've gone to Margaret's training, you'll see a lot of this is very similar. There are some changes. I gotta look at my thing. This isn't what's on my screen. Notice, you have to give for all your meetings 24 hours advance notice. And the notice is called a Class A notice. That's a new thing from last year's legislature. A Class A notice simply means that you have to have it on the Utah Public Notice website and on your Mountain Regional's website. And that notice has to include an agenda. Utah Public Notice website, citizens can go there. They can receive automatic updates. They know when all your meetings are. It becomes a central repository. There are some problems still with the Utah Public Notice website in that they don't do a good job of keeping historical records. So if you have an agenda that they have on the Public Notice website and you go in, you amend your agenda, all they'll keep is the amended agenda, not the original agenda before the amendment. So there are some, at times, problems, but you know, slowly but surely they're working those out. So the big thing is there's no longer a requirement to publish anything in the newspaper.
But are we responsible to keep original and amended?
We should keep all of that. It's just they're not going to archive it. You have to publish annually a schedule of all your general meetings. You publish it in the same manner that you would any other meeting. It's a year-long thing. Although, at this point in time, there's only those two provisions on notice, Utah local website, or Utah public notice website, and the entity's website, you're still encouraged to provide any other way you can to make sure that you've notified the public of your meetings. You know, whether posting on the door to the office or using social media, the idea is we should be encouraging people to come to our meetings.
Do we have social media?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Anna. And then if you look at Anna's report, she actually writes down how many posts she does and the outreach that she does.
Are we put the agendas on there?
We haven't been.
We haven't. They're posted on the website. I'm trying to think if we mentioned it on the billing statement to go to the website. I know it's on the website for sure.
On the door.
We can start posting on social media, though.
Yeah, we can mention it on
our... We can put it on our monthly, you know, the one that goes out.
As I mentioned, the notice has to be, or the agenda has to be in the notice. The contents of the agenda, date, time, place. If it's going to be an electronic meeting, you've got to have the anchor location. You have to have instructions about how people can connect to the electronic meeting. Reasonable specificity on items that are on the agenda. Reasonable specificity doesn't mean general topics. You got to be more specific. And the more specific, the better. If you can hyperlink your agendas so that people can find the staff reports, that is always very helpful.
But when we do a special meeting where we're just going to go into executive session, that's all you can really say, right?
Yeah.
There's nothing really specific.
Okay. No, I mean, you have to state what the executive session, the general topic. So you can go to executive session to discuss
litigation,
imminent
personnel.
Or pending litigation, or you can discuss the character of an individual who's an employee,
personnel,
those kinds of things.
Do we have to notice the groundbreaking?
Well, that's what I'm saying. If we can coordinate it with well, he's going to explain a little change.
I'm going to explain some changes.
Oh, okay.
Here's one of the changes in the statute. Before, we've always had to have a resolution, rule, ordinance that governs your electronic meetings, and you have that in your policies. And it used to be that you could only dispense with an anchor location for an electronic meeting if it was a COVID kind of thing. Substantial risk to the health and safety of those who may be present. Now they have added a new exception where you don't need an anchor location if everybody, all the members of the Administrative Control Board, are going to be on the electronic meeting and no member of the public makes a written request for an anchor location at least 12 hours prior to the meeting, then you don't need an anchor location. Somewhat fraught, because then what happens if the member of the public makes a written request for an anchor location and then you have to amend your agenda? But you can't amend the agenda because it would be within 24 hours, so you would have to move the meeting. So...
Ouch. If somebody figures that out, that could be problematic.
I know. There, as is always legislation, there's always these unintended consequences. But anyway...
Yikes.
We have an anchor location. We're not going to go back.
I think we just have an anchor location. I mean, we generally do. It's just here. Yeah.
Here's the big change. The definition of a meeting. Gathering of a public body with a quorum present, and that is convened by an individual with authority to convene the public body and following the process provided by law for convening the public body for the express purpose of acting as a public body to receive public comment about a relevant matter, deliberate about a relevant matter, or take action upon a relevant relevant matter. Now the key there, one, is what a relevant matter is.
Yes.
The other is convening. Who can convene your meetings? Under our policies, the chair can convene the meetings. So what does this mean? Well, any gathering of a quorum of the public body in which the chair has not formally convened a meeting is not a meeting. Consequently, if you're all invited to go to a groundbreaking and your chair has not formally convened a meeting, it's not a meeting, and you don't have to agenda it.
But you invited us to it.
But it's not a meeting. It's a gathering.
It's not a meeting, right? Because...
gathering.
So as long as Karen doesn't say...
I think it's right.
Formally convene a meeting and open the meeting, then it's not a meeting.
And that kind of gets us makes it easier. Like, last year we showed up to the open meetings training. We were like, oh my gosh, if a third person shows up.
Another board member shows up.
Yeah.
The old rules, we would have had
to... So we'd have to wait in the hall.
Smith's when I ran into you a couple months ago.
I know, because you always run into a couple.
So at the groundbreaking, you're not allowed to talk to each other.
No, you can talk to each other. I'll get over that in a minute. Obviously, you all know that a quorum is a simple majority of the membership, so three.
Yep.
During a meeting, don't be chatting in Zoom with other people. Don't be texting one another or emailing back and forth your deliberations. Say it out loud so it's in the record so everybody knows. So, discussing outside of meetings. So this is, you can forward information to one another. You can discuss things with less than a quorum. But now it's okay to discuss a matter outside of a meeting with a quorum present, so long as the chair has not formally convened the meeting. Now, this could lead to a lot of mischief. So there's another new provision that says individuals constituting a quorum of the public body may not act together outside a meeting in a concerted and deliberate way to predetermine an action to be taken by the public body at the meeting on a relevant matter. So the question is you could all be chatting and discussing something on an email stream with all five of you on. It's not a meeting because Karen hasn't convened a formal meeting. But there's a point at which the discussion becomes deliberations, a concerted and deliberate way you're moving toward a decision. And whatever that point is, that becomes a violation of the Open Meetings Act. So the better course of conduct is to just do what we've been doing all along in terms of discussing relevant matters together. If you have a quorum present, don't do it. Because I don't know what the line is, and I don't necessarily want us to be the test case to find out what that line is.
And definition of relevant matter?
Yes, definition of relevant matter. I'm wondering if I have it in here. I probably do. Relevant matter is anything that's within your authority to do, except nothing on operations and nothing administrative. So if you're talking about an operation or administrative matter, not a legislative matter, then it's not a relevant matter. And you can talk about it with everybody present. Now that may not make any sense, and it doesn't make any sense.
Sorry, yeah, I'm confused. So operations, and what was the other one?
Administrative.
Yeah, it's counterintuitive.
Yeah,
could you give an example? Would it be like they could discuss when to have meetings, or if they need to move a meeting, because that's a ministry?
Yep, they can do that.
Okay.
But, I mean, if there's something that's being discussed that is operational in nature, it's not, you know, you're not using your legislative hat, you're using your administrative executive hat. Technically, you can discuss those things using your executive hat and not be in violation of the Open Meetings Act, even though you're having that discussion. And you're making a decision with a quorum present. Mm-hmm. Emergency meetings, you give the best notice possible, and you have to make an attempt to notify all the members of the board, and a majority of members have to approve to have the emergency meeting. Closed meetings, you can put it on your agenda, or you can always go into a closed meeting from an open meeting, as long as you go through the procedure of voting on it. You have to have at least 2/3 votes, and you keep adequate records of that. So what you do, quorum's present, motion's made to close the meeting. You have to state specifically what the statutory reason for the closure is. Usually it's litigation, or it's personnel, or it's property acquisition. It could be security as well. There's a roll call vote taken. This means everyone has to individually say aye. 2/3 they say must approve it. You have to record it. There are certain cases with security and personnel, it's not recorded, but there's an affidavit that has to be made by the chair. You have to return to the open meeting, also with a roll call vote. So, as I stated, litigation is one. You have to have a recording. You don't need an affidavit. Personnel, you don't need to record it, but you need to have the chair sign an affidavit that it was a personnel item. Property acquisition, yes, recording, no affidavit. Security, so if we're having a closed meeting because we're talking about potential terrorism at one of your wells, no reporting, but you do have to have Karen sign an affidavit.
Where's the recording go?
The recording goes to your clerk. I think the county also will store it if you want them to, the county clerk. What can't you do during a closed meeting? You can't really approve anything. You can't interview a person to fill an elected position. That'll never happen with you all. As I said, you can't take a final vote on anything. There are no meetings that have to be closed. It's always within your discretion. Record keeping, you've got open meetings themselves where you have the written minutes and so forth, and a recording. And the records of the closed meeting are limited in terms of what the written minutes are. Meaning the written minutes are basically why you're having the meeting, the location, what the vote was to go into the executive or closed meeting, date, time, and place, who was present, but really nothing else. You have to make a recording unless it's personal or security, and then it's an affidavit by the chair. Deadlines. Within 3 days of an open meeting, you have to make the audio recording available. You make pending minutes available to the public within a reasonable time. The courts have not defined what a reasonable time is. but you do identify that it's not approved. Then within 3 days after you approve your minutes, then you have to make those available to the public. Enforcement, county attorney, attorney general, really anybody can make a complaint. Courts can enjoin or force compliance with the Open Meetings Act. Attorney's fees are available for violations of the Act. Criminal penalties. This should be civil penalties. Man. Did you get my real...
I just took what you put in here. I didn't doctor it.
I'm going crazy. These are actually civil penalties, civil remedies. You void the final action if you violate the Open Meetings Act. Usually the lawsuit has to be filed within 90 days. A lot of times you can cure a violation of the Open Meetings Act by basically discussing and retaking a public vote in a subsequent open meeting. Intentionally violating open meetings, this is the criminal provision. It's Class B misdemeanor, $1,000 fine. Training, your presiding officer, in this case the chair, make sure that all of you get your Open Meetings Act training. The common violations, you go into a closed meeting without actually voting in the open meeting to go into the close.
Dave, quick question. It said 2/3. So with a body of 5, we'd have to have 4 of the 5 vote to go into the closed meeting.
Correct.
If, let's say, only 3 did, but they still wanted to discuss it, they could still discuss it, but not in a closed meeting?
Well, unless if it's not on the agenda, then they shouldn't either.
Okay.
Unless the chair could allow the discussion, but no vote. Connect a closed meeting for reasons other than those allowed by Open Meetings Act to be discussed. Taking official action in a closed meeting. Failing to properly notice a public meeting. Reasonable specificity. This doesn't really apply much to special service districts, but it's a good thing to understand that although it may not be a specific violation of the Open Meetings Act, but if you've got a pending application where you have an applicant and somebody comes and wants to make public comment during in regular public comment, and they want to make comment on that pending application, you actually can't let them do that. You have to stop them and say, you know, this isn't the appropriate place because we've got a pending application and the applicant isn't here. So as long as the applicant is not there to rebut what anyone wants to say on that application, that's a limitation on public comment during meetings.
Is that personnel and or issues? Like, let's say somebody wanted to make a comment about the Dakota Pacific, but Dakota Pacific wasn't there. They can't make a comment on it? Is that?
Because it's a pending application.
Okay.
They have to go to the specific public hearing where the public can comment on the application.
It's where they have the torches and pitchforks.
Yeah, you see that?
That's the Simpsons at the beginning. I gotcha.
So, parting tips, remember the 24-hour notice. Remember to be specific on your agendas. You cannot take any action on items in a closed meeting, which also means you can't come out of a closed meeting and say, well, whatever we talked about in the closed meeting, I make a motion that we approve that. That's not enough either, because it has to be reasonable specificity on your agenda. People have to know what you're voting on. Remember the provisions that you can close under. Remember to try to provide the minutes in a timely manner. It's mostly for staff. Don't text each other during meetings. Receive training once a year. Err on the side of transparency. When in doubt, ask me or ask Margaret. Liability and immunity. This is how we stay out of trouble. Anytime you act with your legislative hat on, you have what's called absolute immunity. Doesn't mean that somebody's not going to sue and include you in a lawsuit. But if it's on a legislative action, then it's easy for me to get you out of the case. Doesn't apply to injunctions. But most other things it does apply to. Qualified immunity.
Hey, was he giving a cookie? Was he giving a greenie?
Yeah.
I can mute him quick.
Applies to qualified immunity. It applies to administrative decisions and actions. And it means you've got immunity as long as you have not violated a clearly established right. So you're making a decision. You make the decision, and it's an administrative decision. And if you're violating something that Utah courts or, you know, the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals or the United States Supreme Court says is illegal, you don't get qualified immunity. But if you're not violating a clearly established right, then you're given qualified immunity as well. The easiest way to access qualified immunity is called good faith reliance on legal advice. It's a safe harbor. We try to, in our office, give you what the guardrails are, stay within the guardrails, stay within your own lane, and make your decisions within that lane. And then if the district gets sued and you're named in the lawsuit, we'll get you out on qualified immunity. Even if I'm wrong and the right was clearly established. So you might ask, what's legislative and what's administrative as to who's got absolute immunity and who's got qualified immunity? I always look at it as, are you creating something or are you applying it? So, which hat? You know, all of your recommendations on budget are legislative absolute immunity. All your decisions on policies, regulations, if you had a tax to levy, those are all legislative absolute immunity. But if you were applying a law or regulation to a specific person or property, that's administrative. Contracts is administrative. Buying and selling properties are administrative. Personnel decisions are all administrative. Now, if you do get sued, you probably would like the district's insurance carrier to cover you, both in terms of representation and indemnification. And the statute says that as long as you're acting within the scope of employment and you're not acting with malice, then you know, you're going to be covered by the insurance carrier. Even if what you've done violates a clearly articulated law or regulation the courts have said, you know, you shouldn't be doing. As long as you're not willfully doing the misconduct, which means you didn't know about it, and you're not following legal advice, but, you know, your attorney didn't give you any advice on this, you're doing the best you could under the circumstances, but, you know, you're within the scope of your office in making a decision, and you happen to make a decision that violates somebody's clearly articulated right. Well, if you're not willfully doing that, then you're going to be covered by the insurance carrier. So even though you're going to be in the lawsuit, you won't be liable for anything. Malice is an interesting word because it's a word that is a legal term of art. It means a wrongful act with the intent to inflict injury. So this can lead to some circumstances where you may not think you're acting with malice, but the law will say that you are acting with malice. And that could mean that you lose your insurance coverage. And the biggest one are the Open Meetings Act violations, which is the reason why we go over those and make sure you're in compliance. Because sometimes you're doing something and it intentionally violates somebody's rights, but you don't think at the time that it does. But if you know the example I give is something that happened a long time ago, where we had a planning commission in Eastern Summit County, and they didn't have somebody's application on their agenda, and it was back in the 80s, and the person, late 80s, and the applicant came in and said, "Hey, I just want to make sure that, you know, you're okay with me doing X." And everybody looked around and said, "Yeah, we're good with that." You know, at the time, they probably didn't think anything of it. But that's an intentional violation of the Open Meetings Act, because it wasn't on their agenda. It happened to specifically injure this applicant's neighbors. There's a big lawsuit that took me 12 years to resolve. But that is a case where, technically speaking, under the law, if each of them individually had been sued, now luckily they weren't, it was just the county, but if they had been individually sued, they would not have been able to claim the insurance coverage. That's why the Open Meetings Act is important to understand.
And it's considered malice because they had been trained or should have been trained to understand the
Open Meetings Act, and they intentionally violated the Open Meetings Act. They knew that they were supposed to have it on the agenda, but they thought, oh, this is nothing big. It's just, this is our neighbor coming in. We all know him. And, yeah.
Yep. Okay.
Willfully violating the law. This is the reason why the safe harbor rule was put into place, is because if you're following legal advice, you're not viewed as exercising, you know, whatever your discretion is in decision with malice, because you're relying on legal counsel. You're relying on those guardrails. So you'll always be covered by the insurance policy. This is the law that when you act outside the scope of your authority, when you act with malice, this is the lawsuit that comes. It's a federal lawsuit. It's referred to as the Ku Klux Klan Act. It's a 1983 civil rights violation. And the Governmental Immunity Act does not shield anyone as a defense. It used to be that we, you know, when we were getting sued, and the de jure thing to do was to include a 1983 civil rights claim against any governmental entity, and specifically against, you know, all the government officials who made the decision. I think the federal court and the Supreme Court got tired of that, so it doesn't happen as much anymore. But that's what plaintiffs will hold over their heads, because they can get punitive damages where they usually can't when they sue the government. Ethics, conflicts of interest, it's really about those two things. It's about money, it's about family. If you're making a decision that's going to impact one of your family members, I'm not talking about your, you know, cousin fifth removed. I'm talking about, you know, your immediate family. You should recuse yourself. Disclose and recuse. Monetary, if you're going to make money on decisions being made, you should disclose and recuse yourself from the decision making. Anything other than those two, monetary and family, that you might think you have a conflict, it doesn't hurt to just disclose it. You don't have to recuse yourself. If it's, this is going to negatively impact my neighbor, well, they're not family. It isn't about money. You're not making anything off this. Your neighbor may be mad at you, depending on what you do. It's probably a good idea to disclose it. You know, he's my neighbor. But there is no legal prohibition for you to then make a decision on it. Don't solicit gifts. You can accept non-cash gifts with a value of $50 or less. You know, that's basically, you know, Christmas gifts. It used to be when, you know, we had a developer who was really happy about a decision that was made by the planning commission and the planning department. He brought in an entire case of wine, and we had to give it back.
Depends on what kind of wine.
And how many people are you spreading it over?
I guess if it's the wine. It's not $50. No nepotism. So you can't supervise your relative, your immediate relatives. And you board members cannot be employed in the district. You are in the sense that you get a stipend, but in the ethics laws, you're not actually looked at as employees of the district. So, I think that's got to be it.
That's good.
Any questions? I'm going to go back and look at my slides now.
So, Ian, we're not technically required to notice the groundbreaking, but we probably will still do an err on the side of caution. Why change?
Yeah, I'm kind of of the opinion the old rules were easier.
If we notice it, do we have to call a meeting to order at that time?
No. So you're kind of dealing in old world, new world.
Right.
As long as Karen doesn't convene it. And the county council has also been invited. So I don't know if it's their meeting, our meeting. But
I just wonder if can you public notice a meeting that doesn't actually have an agenda and doesn't plan on being.
Well, we
convened.
Used to just notice them, Dave, and say,
yeah.
So-and-so
yeah.
will be attending this presentation. There yeah. may be a quorum at the event.
Okay. Yeah.
But
the agenda
no
was
agenda.
Just, yeah, the intent that
yeah.
four yeah. people might be in the same place at the same time.
Yeah. Is there going to be a separate open public meetings training?
There was. I think it was in February. But in case you missed it, you now got it.
Okay. So this is the only training they need?
This is the only training you need.
Excellent.
Oh, sweet. One instead of two.
Yeah.
Thanks, Dave.
Yeah, that was fantastic. we are on to number 12. Does anyone want to make a motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, that's unanimous. We're adjourned at
Joel thumbed up
8:43.